طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. The news is not good. The unveiling of Trump's deal of the century is the latest slap in the face to the Palestinian people. Israel can do whatever it wants, and the international community stands by and watches former treaties trashed, international law flouted, land stolen, homes demolished, children arrested, discrimination legalized, human rights ignored, and the world averts its eyes. The United States not only endorses this international human rights travesty, but also funds it with our tax dollars to over $3 billion a year. The U.S. gives more foreign aid by far to Israel than any other country, even the undeveloped ones, although the Israeli economy is robust. For instance, Israel guarantees to every citizen state-funded full medical coverage, an accomplishment that we seem unable to achieve here. It is the powerful Israeli lobby that greases the skids for this opulent welfare. It is the corporate media that pushes the Israeli narrative and shuts out the Palestinian voice, and keeps the American public largely uninformed and uninvolved. It is the U.S. Congress that, in response to the pressure and money from the lobby and a largely uncritical, unresponsive press, that does not give balanced coverage and thus betrays the American people. This morning, as is the purpose of this program, you will hear a couple of those muted voices that speak truth to power. This morning we feature journalist and author Max Blumenthal, a great journalist and author whose Middle East insights are prolific and insightful, but due to their honesty are rarely given exposure anymore in the mainstream media. We also feature Syracuse University professor and author Dr. Osama Khalil. They spoke at the annual conference at the Palestine Center last November on the so-called Deal of the Century. We begin with Max Blumenthal.
I've heard a lot about the ultimate deal over the past year, and it's been framed in a way, in the same way that Donald Trump himself has, by people who are observers of Israel-Palestine, particularly people on the liberal side. This is not normal. We've heard that from the so-called resistance to Trump. This is not normal. Everything Trump does is not normal. I see Trump in a different way than they do. I see him as the apotheosis of a failed system. I see him as lifting the mask on so many of the social crises that we've been facing for so long. I see him sort of Trump himself as the result of the ultimate deal between financial capital and the national security state. And so that's how I really see the ultimate deal itself. Because I'm the first speaker, I'll run through some of the most egregious details of it as quickly as possible, and I'll try not to repeat everything everyone else said. But the ultimate deal is simply enacting Netanyahu's wishes, but put forward by someone who literally was in bed with him, Jared Kushner, Jared Kushner, many of you know, was the son of a close friends of Benjamin Netanyahu. And when Netanyahu was in town, when he was an opposition leader or, you know, a young deputy in Yitzhak Shamir's government, he would sleep in Jared Kushner's bed, and Jared Kushner would have to get up and go sleep on the couch. So that tells you who Jared Kushner is. And then the two other figures who are really responsible for this document are Jonathan Greenblatt and David Friedman. You know, I call them team. This is a team Likud. Jonathan Greenblatt's principal role right now is trolling Palestinians on Twitter. I'm not sure what else he does. He's Trump's real estate lawyer, and that is his lone credential. And then you have David Friedman, who was the chairman of the Friends of Beit El, the settlement in the West Bank. You can call him the U.S.-Israeli reciprocal ambassador. He's referred to me as one of the worst anti-Semites in the world at a fundraiser for Trump in Jerusalem, which was, you know, a badge of honor. Then he said Huma Abedin was a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. He's called J Street Capos. So these are some very crude figures, ridiculous characters who've lifted the mask on the idea that the U.S. negotiating team was an honest broker. We can no longer say that. And they've put forward a plan that calls for the removal of exactly zero settlements. They refer to the West Bank and specifically Area C as Judea and Samaria. Jerusalem will not be divided under their plan, which they call Jerusalem the eternal capital. But it will be shared with the new Palestine. The new Palestine. I don't know where that'll be. It'll be divided. It won't be divided, but it will be shared. Israel will maintain political control over the city, and Palestinians have to pay municipal taxes as they currently do. Of course, nothing said about places like Kfar Aqab, which exist on the other side of the separation wall and therefore do not receive municipal services from Jerusalem but have to pay municipal taxes. They also can't receive any services from the Palestinian Authority because they're part of the Jerusalem municipality. So these areas are left for later. The occupation is not referred to at all. It's called a logistical challenge. The Palestinians face logistical challenges. Of course, Palestine will be totally disarmed. Hamas will be disarmed as well somehow, although there's no plan for a state in Gaza, and nothing is said about the end of the siege of Gaza. Kushner pledges to reduce Palestinian unemployment to single digits and promises that expert economists peer-reviewed the ultimate deal. He promises to transform Palestine itself into Singapore and Gaza into Dubai, which I guess means that there will be a Trump Tower in the Jabalia camp. And a transportation corridor between the West Bank and Gaza, where Palestinians will kind of travel on what they call an autostrada, you know, above the, you know, Jewish Israelis, so they don't have to interact and they can go between their reservations. And, you know, of course, he promises healthcare investments and investments in schools, and at the same time, Jared Kushner has completely defunded UNRWA. So the ultimate deal document actually features photographs of UNRWA schools with happy children that Jared Kushner himself has personally defunded. The Gulf states that have now formed a new axis against Iran with Israel will pay 70% of the ultimate deal. They'll cover the tab. And, of course, their goal is to profit from normalization by doing business with Israel and its other allies. This highlights Trump Incorporated's tight bond with the Saudis and the Emiratis. The execution of this deal has been comically bad. It's been worse than the execution of Trump's summits with Kim Jong-un and Putin. Unlike those, however, this is not for a noble cause that could actually bring peace. This is a terrible cause. The Bahrain conference was a complete failure, and I think one of the few Palestinians who would attend, a businessman from Hebron, was basically disowned in the media by his family, what we would call a shanda. As with Trump, the danger with the ultimate deal is that we exceptionalize it and view it outside the context of the dangerous peace process that was consolidated at Oslo. We cannot say that this is not normal. The ultimate deal is, in fact, the ultimate expression of the longstanding peace process that promised that Israel would take peace after peace after peace. It's basically a warmed-over version of what has been offered by liberal Zionists, and it's the Democratic foreign policy establishment that created the political space for Trump's Team Likud to put forward this awful but well-marketed document. The standard-bearer of liberal Zionism, the martyr hero, is Yitzhak Rabin. He's presented as the sort of political counterpoint, ideological counterpoint to Netanyahu and everything he represents. But we have to remember that it was Rabin who promised, when he was prime minister, to remove Gaza from Tel Aviv. Those were his precise words. He revoked thousands of work permits for workers from Gaza and laid the initial stages of the walls around the Gaza Strip. And him and his labor minister, Haim Ramon, presented the initial blueprint for the so-called separation barrier, which we know as an apartheid wall, in and around the Palestinian-occupied West Bank. In his final speech before he was assassinated, before the Knesset, Yitzhak Rabin pledged that he would give Palestinians less than a state. Those were his words, and that was his promise, and that is what he aimed to achieve with Oslo. Ehud Barak, his successor, moved more settlers into the West Bank than Netanyahu ever has, and campaigned on his belief, his statement, that he had more in common personally with the settlers in the West Bank than he did with the cosmopolitan Jews in Tel Aviv. Of course, today, the liberal Zionists are stuck with Benny Gantz, former Israeli Army Chief of Staff, whose campaign launch ad featured a baritone voice boasting of how many people Benny Gantz killed in Gaza over images of the rubble of Shujaiya. So another mask-lifting moment on liberal Zionism. I described to you Team Likud, this ridiculous cast of characters, who make Alan Dershowitz seem reasonable. Under the past administrations, from Bill Clinton to George W. Bush, you had team status quo. Figures like Dennis Ross, Martin Indyk, Aaron David Miller, a whole cast of characters and diplomats like Jeffrey Feltman, who represented something that was analogous to Team Likud. They represented not a different vision of Israel-Palestine, but a different wing of the pro-Israel consensus. So Martin Indyk is actually originally from Australia, and he came to the U.S. from Australia to ensure that the U.S. maintained a pro-Israel slant in its foreign policy in the 1980s. Indyk actually said at J Street in 2009 that he made aliyah to the United States. He started his first job in 1982 as a deputy researcher at AIPAC. Then 3 years later, him and Dennis Ross founded WINEP, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, out of AIPAC. It was basically AIPAC's think tank. Ross's first paper for WINEP, which he published in 1985, demanded the appointment of a non-Arabist special Middle East envoy who would not feel guilty about our relationship with Israel and our reluctance to force Israeli consensus, in Washington. That's him describing himself and his future role alongside Dennis Ross and many other figures. Dennis Ross was responsible in 2008 for Barack Obama's notorious speech at AIPAC, where Obama declared that Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel and it must remain undivided. Again, creating space for Donald Trump to move the embassy funded by Sheldon Adelson, the U.S. embassy, to Jerusalem. Ross, when he was out of power, out of the George W. Bush administration, where he served as the point man on the peace process, collected $230,000 a year from WINEP, as well as $220,000 in speaking fees from pro-Israel organizations, essentially a reward for all of the great things he did at Camp David and before at Oslo. That's how the peace process functions in Washington. I talked to you about David Friedman, the U.S.-Israeli reciprocal ambassador, the original U.S.-Israeli reciprocal ambassador, or the one who normalized David Friedman, was Daniel Shapiro, who was Obama's ambassador. And what did he do when Barack Obama left power after presiding over more disproportionate violence against Palestinians than any other president? The three major Israeli operations against Gaza. Shapiro chose to stay in Israel with his family and be an Israeli where he felt at home. This was the U.S. ambassador, and this was treated as completely normal here. So since then, Dennis Ross has continued to put forward proposals that he hopes a future Democratic president might take up, which look almost precisely like the ultimate deal. Ross has called for in 2017 in a paper at WinEP, a differentiated approach to settlements, accepting construction in existing settlement blocks in exchange for Israeli agreement to stop building outside them. This is precisely what the ultimate deal calls for. No Israeli withdrawal from East Jerusalem. Israel gets the Jordan Valley. Palestinians get merely economic activity in Area C, which means they're cheap labor. And, of course, you have the same relationship that you see between Jared Kushner and Team Likud and Mohammed bin Salman and Dennis Ross. Dennis Ross has become a de facto lobbyist for the Saudi royals. He's described Mohammed bin Salman as a driving force for change and a revolutionary in op-eds for the Washington Post, where he's constantly touting MBS's 2030 agenda. This is slightly more subtle than E.J. Kimball, the Israel lobbyist from Daniel Pipes' Middle East Forum, who said that Jamal Khashoggi deserved to die because of his connections to the Muslim Brotherhood. But the differences are in shades of gray, not black and white. Now, finally, the real core of the ultimate deal, as Joseph Massad explained so eloquently this morning, I guess it's still this morning, was an economic peace, a neoliberal economic peace, buying off Palestinian elites in exchange for political subjugation, which was also at the core of the Paris Accords, which represented the essence of Salam Fayyad's doomed tenure as Prime Minister of Palestine. Fayyad was celebrated in Western media for advancing many of the same concepts that Jared Kushner has. The Gulf-funded Middle East Institute, for example, described Fayyadism and Fayyad's 2009 push for statehood as encouragingly benign. It's benign. It won't do anything. That encourages us. Out of Fayyadism came Rawabi, a version of Loudoun County or Temecula, California, airdropped into the occupied West Bank, built, as Joseph said, by Bashar al-Masri, and Bashar al-Masri, before he was negotiating with Aviv Kohavi, had negotiated with Dov Weissglass, Ehud Olmert's fixer, to build a road through Area C, and the original organization that was going to provide the trees for Rawabi was the Jewish National Fund, the architect of Israeli settler colonialism and the Nakba. Actually, ran into Bashar at his restaurant, Fuego in Ramallah, and asked him about that, and he denied it. He denied all the reports, so I feel like I have to... And then his waiters were frightened for me. Then, you know, the idea when of Fayyadism, also, it separates Gaza from the West Bank and has this West Bank-first approach where the West Bank will be built up as this kind of example of a neoliberal Palestine and Gaza will be punished in order to teach Hamas a lesson and teach Palestinians who reject this approach a lesson, which makes the idea of a transportation corridor even more remote. But we should look at the liberal Zionist plans for a transportation corridor. For example, the one put forward in Harper's Magazine by the liberal Zionist author and intellectual Bernard Avishai. And this was in an article where Avishai was trying to explain how the right of return for refugees could be possible. And he put forward a plan for a tunnel between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank so Jewish Israelis would never even have to see the Palestinian Morlocks as they went through the underground tunnel. We have to completely disappear them because the liberal Zionists always emphasize hard separation more than the Likudniks. The groundwork for the ultimate deal really comes out of these World Economic Forum conferences where previous presidents have put forward neoliberal plans for Palestine. George W. Bush in 2008 proposed an economic bailout for Palestine, and then 5 years later, John Kerry presented his Breaking the Impasse plan, during a speech at the World Economic Forum where he did not mention the occupation once and provided very few details. In fact, one of the only details that Kerry offered was that his breaking the impasse would be presided over by the ultimate used car dealer of Middle East diplomacy, Tony Blair, who is the leader of Tony Blair Incorporated, a gigantic international hustle that's generated over $100 million in profits for Tony Blair and his minions through lobbying gigs for tyrants and work for J.P. Morgan, which reaped a major windfall profit when Blair opened up West Bank markets for the Qatari-owned cellcom provider Watania, which happened to be also owned by J.P. Morgan, so Blair's employer. By 2014, after Israel devastated the West Bank, John Kerry was back at it. He put forward a new economic plan authored by McKinsey and Associates that was leaked to me by a Palestinian businessman. It was basically a 3 or 4 page document. It described Gaza and the West Bank as kind of normal societies, just like any other countries, that simply underperformed on tourism metrics. That's the language McKinsey used. Gaza underperforms on tourism metrics, and they chalk that up to quote-unquote regional instability, completely ignoring the siege. No mention of occupation or siege in this document. McKinsey proposed a range of new hotel offerings in Gaza to bring the economy back to life. And finally, it called for building literal sweatshops in the Gaza Strip that would produce buttons and zippers for high-end designers in Tel Aviv. Maybe some hipsters could wear those buttons and zippers on their uniforms for the next offensive in the Gaza Strip. This was the plan that was put forward. The only details of the plan that I could find had to be leaked to me by Obama. Now, finally, something that's often left out of the discussion is the Golan Heights, or what I like to call the Stolan Heights. Many people gasped when a new Israeli settlement was inaugurated called Trump Heights. I mean, this is just so crude and such a naked consecration of permanent occupation. It's natural to be disgusted by it. But who created the political space for the Israelis and the Trump administration to declare out in the open, in plain sight, that the Golan Heights, the Syrian Golan Heights, would be annexed, and that Resolution 242 would be just ripped up and thrown away? It was the Obama administration, when the Obama administration supported the dirty war on Syria and declared that the UN-recognized Syrian government had to go and voided Syria's sovereignty. And it also allowed Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel to say that we no longer have to sit down at the table with Anwar Assad. And that is what has allowed, created the political space for Israel to rip up negotiations over the Golan Heights and the U.S. to declare that it belongs permanently to Israel. And I remember being, basically, there was an attempt to blacklist me within the Palestine Solidarity Movement for pointing that out and for writing several exposés on the dirty war in Syria, specifically on the White Helmets, which was an influence operation that sought to push U.S. intervention in Syria. Well, the White Helmets in 2018 were evacuated by Israel through the Syrian Golan Heights and into Jordan. I have nothing further to say about that. We're in an interesting era right now. We've been talking about the elections, and we have people like Pete Buttigieg, who worked at McKinsey and Associates, who's spouting the same language we've heard for decades about shared values between the U.S. and Israel. Elizabeth Warren has said she favors a two-state solution, which is the same thing. To paraphrase George H.W. Bush about Bill Clinton, her foreign policy experience seems to be limited to having breakfast at the International House of Pancakes. So basically, her brain is going to be rented by a bunch of think tank fellows from the Center for American Progress. It's not a very good prospect. I disagree slightly about Bernie, but you know, you can imagine him getting rolled if he gets into office. But he made some interesting comments recently that have moved the Democratic field while speaking at J Street, that aid to Israel will be conditioned on its respect for human rights. If he follows through with that, it could be similar to something that George H.W. Bush did to Shamir, and it could move things on the ground. It would be at least a remarkable change from the status quo. We need to ensure that this interesting discussion that's playing out within the Democratic field, thanks to pressure that the Palestine Solidarity Movement put on Bernie Sanders, who didn't used to take these positions, does not remain just that, and that it actually moves the facts on the ground, that it actually shifts the situation away from a deadly status quo and settler colonialism that has been consolidated by the status quo of a peace process pushed by both parties in Washington. Thank you.
That was journalist and author Max Blumenthal speaking at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. Next, we present Professor Osama Khalil, who is history professor at Syracuse University, teaching U.S. foreign relations in the modern Middle East. We begin with his introduction at the annual conference at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C.
He's the author of America's Dream Palace, Middle East Expertise and the Rise of National Security State, and the editor of United States Relations with China and Iran. Without further ado, please, Dr. Osama.
It's not easy to be the last speaker before lunch, so I'll try not to keep it too long. But I want to take a moment to thank Dr. Subhi and Dr. Eid and all the members of the Palestine Center Board for organizing the conference and all the great work they do here in the nation's capital, in the United States, and in Palestine. It's an essential institution, so thank you again. I want to thank Muhammad and Samita for their help with logistics in the conference, and of course to my fellow panelists. So there's a tendency, and I think you've heard some of this often in the media, maybe less so today, but there's a tendency to discuss Trump's actions and policies, including the deal, as a break with U.S. foreign policy. Right? The reality is that deal and Trump, as some of the speakers have already said, is more consistent with U.S. foreign policy over the past 7 to 8 decades, if not further back, if not back to, quite frankly, the Wilson administration, than has been recognized. There is a difference in style and rhetoric. That's clear. Right? But as I'll show you today, what has been done secretly or talked about secretly by American officials and in documents and agreements with the Israelis, what has been done secretly is now done openly, and in typical Trump fashion, loudly, right? We have to take credit for everything and announce it two times over and put a Trump label on it. But since World War I, Washington has viewed Palestinians as an inconvenient reality. And it's an inconvenient they are an inconvenient reality to be essentialized and erased. So what do I mean by that? In other words, they were essentialized as part of the broader Arab world, either as Arabs or as Arab refugees, right, without legitimate political rights and without an attachment to Palestine. I'll talk more about that in a moment. The deal continues this trend. The second major point to take away is that there will be no deal. Right? The deal will not be presented. Right? The elections are less than a year away. Donald Trump is not going to present the deal in an election year. Right? Now, it will not be presented until after 2021, if ever. But as Max pointed out, it'll be adapted and adopted with a different packaging, a new and improved deal, perhaps with a Democratic administration or perhaps in the second Trump administration. And as we've talked about, and there have been a couple of questions about this, the Democratic candidates, none of them, are going to roll back Trump's decisions, not on Jerusalem, not on the Golan, not on anything he may do in the next 11 months to please Sheldon Adelson or somebody else. Right? It's not going to happen. Even though Bernie Sanders has made, to Max's point, and I think Max is right, he's made some very important points about linking U.S. aid to Israel, to human rights. We've heard this before. during the Carter administration. Right? And as I like to tell my students when we talk about the Carter administration and his amazing human rights policy, there was an exception to Carter's human rights policy, right? And every state was an exception. Right? So, none of the Democratic candidates will roll back, and even if Bernie Sanders is elected, it is unlikely that Congress will go along. Now, fourth, as long as there is a collaborationist leadership, a collaborationist Palestinian leadership, Palestinians cannot expect any change in their status and achieving their rights and achieving self-determination and certainly not statehood. So, one aspect of the deal that has been often discussed, right, is that there will not be a Palestinian state at the end, right, and not a sovereign Palestinian state. This is not new, right? And in fact, we can take this back to the origins of the peace process, not Oslo, further back to the 1970s, to the 1960s with 242, right? So this is a quote from Secretary of State James Baker. Is at the end of the Gulf War. This is 6 months before the Madrid process, and he makes it clear. And this should look familiar, right? It's pretty much what you have today, right? I will tell you one thing as Secretary of State. Here he's talking to one of King Hussein's key advisors, a Palestinian. There will be no Palestinian state. There will be an entity, less than a state, more than autonomy. That's the best we can reach with the Israelis. Okay. So, that's March of 1991. Now, of course, you're probably wondering, right, how did we get to this situation? If you remember the Madrid Peace Conference, the Palestinians, the PLO, was not allowed to participate. Right? There was an Israeli veto on PLO participation. There was a joint Palestinian-Jordanian confederation in terms of a negotiating team, but the PLO was, quote-unquote, not allowed to participate openly. Right? And this is, in part, the issue. Right? For the PLO to participate, it meant trading away Palestinian self-determination and statehood as an essential prerequisite for the PLO to participate. This is 1976, in the middle of the first phase of the Lebanese Civil War. And this is Secretary of State Henry Kissinger talking to two of his ambassadors, Herman Eilts and Thomas Pickering. Now keep in mind some context. Kissinger is under pressure in an election year. Sound familiar? In an election year from President Anwar Sadat to begin talking to the PLO as a way to end the Lebanese Civil War and as a reward for Sadat's signature on the Sinai II disengagement agreements. And so Sadat is talking to the U.S. ambassador, and the U.S. ambassador is trying to pressure Kissinger. Give something to Sadat, he tells him. And here's Henry. We cannot deliver the minimum demands of the PLO, so why talk to them? So, the minimum demands. Okay. So how did the PLO become a party to the negotiations, you're wondering? Right? In a way, this takes us back to the point I made about Palestinians having to be essentialized and erased. Right? So you can essentially divide U.S. policy towards the Palestinians in three phases. In the first phase, roughly from 1948 to 1974, Palestinians were to be treated as a humanitarian problem, not a political one, right? No political representation. The hope was the United States would be able to arrange a peace deal with the Arab states and force the resettlement of Palestinian refugees where they were and negate the presence of the rest, right? They would just fall within the population of the existing Arab states or as the Arab minority in Israel. After 1974, as the PLO gained recognition, right, as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, then the idea was to ignore them, as the Kissinger quote tells you. That will continue until roughly 1993 in the Oslo Accords. And with Oslo, the goal was the following, to co-opt the PLO and pressure them, as we see culminating with the deal of the century. Right. Now, one aspect of this is that always, Israel's demands take primacy. Here you have two documents, separated by 23 years. The second is during Oslo, and the first is linked to the Sinai II agreement. This is a secret memorandum of understanding that accompanied Sinai II. One of the aspects you always hear about this memorandum of understanding is the following, that the U.S. agreed, negotiated by Henry Kissinger, not to negotiate with or recognize the PLO until it recognized Israel. Here's the aspect you don't hear about. Right? Israel's veto. Israel's veto on any attempts to present some kind of formulation that they would object to. 23 years later, in the middle of Oslo, you have a very similar formulation in a letter from Secretary of State Albright to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. All right, let's take a look. Take a look at the first one. The United States government will not join in and will not seek to prevent efforts by others to bring about consideration proposals which it and Israel agree are detrimental to the interests of Israel. 1998, recognizing the desirability of avoiding putting forward proposals that Israel would consider unsatisfactory, the U.S. will conduct a thorough consultation process with Israel and advance with respect to any ideas the U.S. may wish to offer to the parties for their consideration. It's particularly true with respect to security issues or territorial issues. So, the price for participation is acquiescing in Israel's demands. Now, the other key piece of this is that even when the United States talks about Palestinian state, and many of you, I'm sure, are wondering, but what about all these negotiations that have gone on, and there have been all these talks about creating a Palestinian state? You'll remember that that doesn't start until George W. Bush had his vision, right? Because there was nothing embedded in the Oslo agreements that guaranteed at the final state was a Palestinian state. There's nothing written in there. You will not find it. The other aspect that tells you that that's true is, to Max's point about Dennis Ross and his role, is that once the United States got involved in the Oslo process, the negotiations got dragged out, became more complicated, and then ultimately failed. Which leads us to the Bush administration. So one of the key aspects with Bush's vision, and this is consistent, is that once again, Israel's demands have primacy. And in giving Israel's demands primacy and enforcing acquiescence to those demands, it creates an unresolvable contradiction in which Palestinian rights, Palestinian statehood, Palestinian self-determination are negated. What do I mean by that? April 14, 2004 letter from Bush to Sharon. At the top, you'll see the discussion of the right of return. And notice how it's framed. Right. Now, you don't have to be a lawyer to analyze this. This is pretty clear-cut. W couldn't write one in legal language anyway. So, the United States is strongly committed to Israel's security and will begin, and well-being, I'm sorry, as a Jewish state. It seems clear, all right, that an agreed, just, fair, and realistic framework to the Palestinian refugee issue will be part of an agreement, will need to be found through the establishment of a Palestinian state and the settling of Palestinian refugees there. So there's the refugees. Number two, Israel must have secure and recognized borders. In light of new realities on the ground, including already existing major Israeli population centers, it is unrealistic to expect the final outcome to be a return to the 1949 armistice lines. And he tells you, again, taking us to the deal, all previous efforts to negotiate a two-state solution have reached the same conclusion. This is 2004. It is realistic to expect that any final status agreement will only be achieved on the basis of mutually agreed changes that reflect these realities. But then he tells you, the United States, in accordance with his vision, that as we know came to him from a divine intervention, that the United States supports the establishment of a Palestinian state that is viable, contiguous, sovereign, and independent, so the Palestinian people can build their own future. These do not match. It is impossible, with the existing realities on the ground, to have a viable, contiguous, independent Palestinian state. So, where does that leave us? And what do we do now? There is a one-state apartheid reality today. There is no peace process, and there will not be a Palestinian state. No matter what individuals here in the D.C. think tanks tell you, what the Democratic presidential candidates say, or what peace process veterans want to say because they can get more speaking fees. What is to be done is that if Palestinians hope for a change in Washington, they must abandon their collaborationist Palestinian leadership. And they must abandon engagement in the peace process charade. The only way rights will be achieved is through a broad-based movement for full and total equality. And that requires abandoning this reliance of the peace process on the halls of power, on the negotiators, on Saab Etikot's endless speeches. That's at least one benefit. And it means preference given to grassroots movements on an international level, pushing for not just human rights, full and total political, civil, and religious rights. Total equality. And that means a preference given to grassroots mobilizing and organizing. Thank you.
You have been listening to Syracuse history professor Osama Khalil speaking at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. No, the news is not good for Palestinians or for those who stand with them. But we cannot afford to despair. We have to become more active participants in their resistance. We need to push back against the Israeli lobby's highly financed and organized attempts to silence Palestinian voices on U.S. college campuses. We need to demand more balanced coverage of the Middle East in our media. And we need to pester our congressional leaders to give leadership to causes of human rights that they too frequently ignore so as not to turn off their financial backers. When all is said and done, it's all about the Benjamins, baby. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts, hoping you will become involved in the struggle for human rights. So long, until next week.